Welcome to Chapter 5 of our series, trying to answer the question, are we heading to a dystopian future? In this chapter, we will dig through the incredible novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? By Philip K. Dick. If you haven't read the novel, give me a thumbs up, because I did it for you. If you have, this would be an excellent opportunity to share this video with someone who hasn't. And while there are a few spoilers ahead, if you find this book intriguing, feel free to use the link to Amazon or Audible to buy the book, or use any of the other links in the description to support my work. This chapter will be broken into four parts, with this, the first part, giving an extensive overview of the book, providing you with everything you need to know to plow through the rest of this lengthy chapter. Now, before I start, I do need to emphasize that Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is, first and foremost, a profound philosophical exercise. As such, much of the overview will have to cover the philosophical quandaries that underlay the book, thus going well above merely examining the aspects of the dystopian future it describes. And with that trigger alert out of the way, let's dig in. Part 1. Introduction. Preface. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is a dystopian science fiction novel published in 1968 and written by the psychedelic sci-fi author Philip K. Dick, whom I shall, from now on, refer to as PKD because I don't feel comfortable being on a first-name basis with him, and even more reluctant to call him by his last name, Dick. Also, just so you'll know who we're talking about, in 1977, PKD came up with the idea that we live in a sort of a computer program where déjà vus are a sign that the programmer made some change to it. In other words, he inspired the Matrix trilogy. Although, crucially, in PKD's version, the programmer is a placeholder for God. This, mind you, isn't all too surprising since PKD was deeply religious. Oh, and a super lefty too. And, if I might add, a bit cuckoo in the head. Other than that, there is one crucial thing you need to understand about PKD's novels. They are stories made of intertwining fables built into overarching allegories wrapped in innuendos and threaded with existential philosophical questions. This means that just like the Bible, you can take the text at face value as well as some kind of encoded scripture. In fact, his books can only be described as theological sci-fi. Therefore, when I go into the between-the-lines meanings, remember that it should not take away from the straightforward interpretation of PKD's depictions. In other words, what's between the lines doesn't negate what's in the lines. Oh, and a really important note. In this chapter, you will hear the word empathy mentioned about 10 to the 10 times. So note that in the absolute majority of cases, empathy will stand for its official definition, the ability to understand and share the feelings of another, and not the colloquial use of the word as a synonym to sympathy. Although in some specific cases, you can still use them interchangeably based on the context. If you're more technical, then you can simply think of empathy as a synonym of sorts to the ultimate solution to the alignment problem in AGI, or Artificial General Intelligence. For those of you who don't know what it is, I suggest looking it up now, since the term will inevitably make more and more headlines in the years to come. And with that, let's overview the dystopian world of PKD's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Overview. Do androids dream of electric sheep? Follows a bounty hunter called Rick Deckard, whose job is to eliminate androids who killed and escaped their masters. This is pretty much what the movie Blade Runner reduced the book to. But we are not here to examine the adaptation, but rather the original novel. The story takes place in 1992, in a post-apocalyptic San Francisco, after Earth was devastated by a nuclear war called World War Terminus. Given the book was written at the height of the Cold War, it wouldn't surprise you that the belligerents were the United States and the Soviet Union. You might be surprised, however, that the war had no apparent reason. Although, according to the book, the war definitely had something to do with the Rand Corporation, which, if you don't know, is, or at least was, a military-industrial complex lobbying group disguised as a think tank. Anyway, World War Terminus annihilated most of life on Earth, and, for good measure, also left a giant cloud of radioactive dust encircling the Earth. To make sure everything in this world is entirely dreadful, this dust cloud was slowly genetically degenerating and killing off what little remained of life. This has motivated the US government to make its colony on Mars a replacement for Earth, where humanity will flourish without the threat of being eliminated. Although it seems from the book that this escape to Mars, while an American project, is nonetheless an international endeavor. Now, because the novel is very complex, I will have to go into quite a bit of detail in this overview before we can start exploring the world's societal and socio-political characteristics. And we will begin with the sanctity of life. While humans dwindled in numbers to the point where cities were mostly abandoned, nature and the animal world suffered even more. Entire landscapes lay barren, and whole species of animals and insects went extinct, or were on the verge of extinction. This has elevated the worth of living creatures, especially mammals, to be on par with that of humans, as life itself has become sacred. All living things were revered, and their preservation became the ultimate endeavor of those who survived. Interestingly, with life itself becoming the most precious thing to humanity, abortions were also outlawed, with the penalty being a life sentence. In fact, surveillance, which is heavily featured in many dystopian novels, is only mentioned in one case. The police are always watching for abortions. But the sanctity of life didn't apply to all in the same measure. For instance, humans who were too genetically degenerated to reproduce could be said to have occupied a lower class, receiving little care from the rest of humanity. But notably, the least living thing in the novel were androids. However, this is where things get a little murky, because the androids PKD describes are highly intelligent, free-willed organic beings. This, of course, poses a question. If life is sacred, what defines one as living? And as the novel's title suggests, this is the central question PKD is trying to address, at least at face value. PKD approaches this question from multiple angles, starting with, why aren't androids worthy of enjoying that world's foundational reverence for life? To the more general question, if the fake is indistinguishable from the real, what makes it fake? This is probably unsurprising to you if you are familiar with PKD's works, as they routinely deal with the subject of simulacra or simulacrums. Incidentally, the quote-unquote philosopher Jean blah blah Baudrillard essentially plagiarized, twisted, butchered, and pretty much destroyed PKD's observations. Not that you should expect any less from a philosopher described as the high priest of postmodernism. And with that, let's go back to our subject matter, starting with this world's sanctity of life, as it is expressed in what I call the capitalism of the sacrosanct. The most interesting way in which this world's newly found sanctity of life is manifested is the treatment of animals. Using animals like we do for food, clothing, and so on is so morally repugnant for humans in this post-apocalyptic world, it's unthinkable to the point of disgust. In fact, it is seen as one's moral duty and religious obligation of sorts to own and care for animals. Therefore, owning and caring for an animal reflected your morals and ethics. This made animals the most coveted commodity on Earth, driving the demand for animals to unprecedented heights. Now, with demand for animals at an all-time high and their mass extinction driving their supply to an all-time low, their monetary value obviously shot up. Thus, owning animals also became a status symbol, and just like any other status symbol, the more valuable, the better. Obviously, animals being so expensive meant that not all people could afford one. And with market forces being what they are, this had opened an entirely new market that deals in electromechanical animal replicas. Since owning an animal is so important for the sense of self-worth and society's view of you, it was essential that no one would be able to tell if your animal was fake, including, to some extent, the owner. Therefore, fake animals were made to be so perfect that they were indistinguishable from real animals in appearance, behavior, and need for care. So much so that even malfunctions were disguised with simulated disease. Now, as you might expect, to fix the malfunction disguised as a disease, the contraption disguised as an animal is taken to a technician disguised as a vet in a van disguised as an ambulance. This, of course, ties back to the question posed by PKD: can we really tell the fake from the real? And more profoundly, does it really matter? By the way, now that I mentioned electric animals, you hopefully get the full meaning behind the book's title. In case you haven't, PKD makes sure to tell us that Rick, the human bounty hunter, has an electric sheep, but dreams of replacing it with a real one. Speaking of fakes, let's move on to the synthetic freedom fighter. Still on the issue of the sanctity and preservation of life, humans who were not yet sick and who were deemed safe to reproduce were permitted, and in fact encouraged, to emigrate to the American Martian colony. As the American government's propaganda put it, emigrate or degenerate, the choice is yours. A slogan that appeared on posters, TV ads, and junk mail. However, the choice wasn't entirely yours. For instance, if you were genetically defective due to the radioactive dust cloud, you didn't have the right to emigrate to begin with. Regardless, emigration to Mars was nonetheless encouraged, not least by offering immigrants a personal slave in the form of a humanoid, flesh-and-blood android. As PKD put it, a weapon of war, the synthetic freedom fighter had been modified. Able to function on an alien world, the humanoid robot, strictly speaking, the organic android, had become the mobile donkey engine of the colonization program. End quote. There's an interesting part in the book where we hear an exchange taking place between a reporter and a recent immigrant to Mars that will help illustrate the role of the androids, which goes as follows.
"Let's hear from Mrs. Maggie Klugman," the TV announcer suggested. "A recent immigrant to Mars," Mrs. Klugman, in an interview taped live in New York, had this to say. "Mrs. Klugman, how would you contrast your life back on contaminated Earth with your new life here in a world rich with every imaginable possibility?" A pause, and then a tired, dry, middle-aged female voice said,
"I think what I and my family of three noticed most was the dignity."
"The dignity, Mrs. Klugman?" the announcer asked.
"Yes," Mrs. Klugman said. "It's a hard thing to explain. Having a servant you can depend on in these troubled times, I find it reassuring."
End quote. Given that these machines started out as weapons, it probably wouldn't surprise you that they occasionally killed their owners and escaped their servitude on Mars back to Earth. While you might not be surprised, it seems that most people in that world would be, as the extent of it was pretty much kept under wraps. The only people who really knew how serious the problem was were android manufacturers, governments, and law enforcement agencies, especially those of Soviet Russia and the USA. The androids depicted in the novel are highly advanced, organic, and intelligent. And since, as I've said, they occasionally kill their owners to escape being slaves, one can assume they have both free will and wish to live in freedom and liberty. In fact, androids even have names, and they even get married to other androids. The problem is that this sounds like pretty much a living person. Take, for instance, the following quote when our bounty hunter Rick is searching for something in the purse of a female android. "Like a human woman, Rachel had every class of object conceivable filched and hidden away in her purse." End quote. So, the obvious question is, what makes androids non-living? Or at least, what makes them unworthy of enjoying the perks of the sanctity of life? According to the book, two main differences exist between androids and humans that manufacturers haven't been able to solve. 1. Androids live for only a few short years. 2. Androids lack any form of empathy. Or, to rephrase Shakespeare, if you prick them, they will bleed. If you poison them, they will die. If you wrong them, they will revenge, but if you tickle them, they will not laugh. Still, if you were to pass by an android, you wouldn't be able to spot it unless you ran a bone marrow test on it or tested its empathic reactions. Therefore, the bounty hunters tasked with capturing rogue androids must run an empathy test to determine if the subject in front of them is an android. If it was, it would be eliminated
on the spot, or, to use the novel's euphemism, retired. The empathy test by which androids are identified in the book is called the Voight-Kampff empathy test. It is a polygraph-like test developed in Soviet Russia to detect the more advanced android models. The Voight-Kampff test measures physical responses to a set of questions that put the subject in a hypothetical immoral scenario. The premise of the test is that human morality is innate and subconscious in nature. Thus, the depicted scenario immediately elicits an emotional reaction followed by a physiological response carried out by the visceral or autonomous motor system with little to no lag. Androids, on the other hand, first need to logically identify the moral issue in the scenario and its severity, a problem in its own right, and then generate an artificial response. Given that animals are sacred, many of the hypothetical scenarios used to measure the subject's empathic reactions are situations in which animals are harmed. For instance, in the book, a question the bounty hunter Rick Deckard asks a potential android is, "You are watching an old movie on TV. A movie from before the war. It shows a banquet in progress. The guests are enjoying raw oysters." End quote. Here you might uncomfortably notice that humans living in our own world would fail the test entirely and be promptly retired, which I'm sure is a point vegans would eagerly point out, if not outright endorse its consequences. For morality's sake, of course. Although there's a killer feature question depicted in a scene when Rick Deckard tests a potential android called Rachel. "My briefcase," Rick said as he rummaged for the Voight-Kampff forms. "Nice, isn't it? Department issue."
"Well, well," Rachel said remotely.
"Baby hide," Rick said. He stroked the black leather surface of the briefcase. 100% genuine human baby hide. End quote. Rachel failed the test, even though she was one of the advanced Nexus 6 model androids. Other than short lives and lack of empathy, there are a few more differences. I will go into those later in my analysis. Still, there is one difference I want to point out now. Unlike humans who will fight and beg for their life till the bitter end, androids seem more willing to accept their fate when a bounty hunter is about to retire them. To help explain this point, in the book, when a female android believes that Rick is about to kill her, PKD remarks, "The life force oozed out of her, as Rick had so often witnessed before with other androids. The classic resignation, mechanical, intellectual acceptance of that which a genuine organism with 2 billion years of the pressure to live and evolve haggarding it could never have reconciled itself to." End quote. From the android's lack of empathy, let's now switch to how empathy is experienced by humans. And I will call this segment communitarian empathy. Another differentiator PKD highlights is the communitarian nature of humans versus the solitary nature of androids. To help highlight this point, let me quote from a portion of the book where PKD muses on behalf of the protagonist the following. "He had wondered, as had most people at one time or another, precisely why an android bounced helplessly about
when confronted by an empathy measuring test. Empathy, evidently, existed only within the human community, whereas intelligence, to some degree, could be found throughout every phylum and order, including the arachnids. For one thing, the empathic faculty probably required an unimpaired group instinct. A solitary organism, such as a spider, would have no use for it. In fact, it would tend to abort a spider's ability to survive. It would make him conscious of the desire to live on the part of his prey. Hence, all predators, even highly developed mammals such as cats, would starve. Empathy, he had once decided, must be limited to herbivores, or anyhow, omnivores who could depart from a meat diet, because, ultimately, the empathic gift blurred the boundaries between hunter and victim, between the successful and defeated. End quote. This communitarian aspect of humans versus androids is further sharpened throughout the book, especially when considering the religion practiced in that world, which I will explore in length in the social characteristics portion. For now, I will distill PKD's assertion to the following. Humans have an innate capacity to irrationally put the good of others, and indeed life itself, above or on par with that of their own. Androids, on the other hand, have no such tendency. Furthermore, in the book, androids themselves lament that they will betray each other in the blink of an eye if it serves their interests. In other words, androids completely disregard life, artificial and natural alike. They are, to put it bluntly, psychopaths. If you remember, in the quote I provided, PKD gives spiders as an example of non-empathic creatures. This is not an arbitrary choice, as later in the book, an escaped android rips off legs from a spider just to see what's the minimum number of legs it really needs. You know, just in case you have doubts as to who the bad guys are. That said, we learn from Rick Deckard himself that, while rare, there were two cases he knew of when androids owned and cared for animals. But, as he says to a fellow bounty hunter, "From what I've been able to learn, it generally fails. The Andy is unable to keep the animal alive. Animals require an environment of warmth to flourish, except for reptiles and insects." End quote. As you surely notice, this puts androids on par with insects and reptiles, which begs the question, why should the lives of reptiles and insects be revered, but not that of androids? At this point, PKD devolves to the utilitarian argument for human supremacy. To explain, at least in part, how the killing of androids can be justified, PKD brings up a survival-based utilitarian argument. As another bounty hunter put it, "If we included androids in our range of empathic identification, as we do animals, these Nexus 6 types, they'd roll all over us and mash us flat. You and I, all the bounty hunters, we stand between the Nexus 6 and mankind, a barrier which keeps the two distinct." End quote. Now, armed with a background and leading features of the story, let's do a brief synopsis before getting to the meat of the matter. As mentioned, the book's protagonist is a bounty hunter named Rick Deckard, whose job is to kill or retire rogue androids, i.e., androids who killed their masters on Mars and escaped to Earth. The book revolves around 24 hours or so, during which Rick Deckard kills 6 escaped androids, an unprecedented feat by any bounty hunter, and one that drains him physically and emotionally. Crucially, these androids belong to a new class of androids armed with the new Nexus 6 brain, which is intellectually superior to any android model that came before it. Importantly, it almost seems that part of the manufacturer's motivation for creating this new brand of androids is to create artificial beings that can pass the empathy test. Notice, I'm not saying endowing androids with actual empathy, just making them able to pass the empathy test. Personally, I think this is PKD giving his opinion that corporations aren't willing to, or cannot, manufacture anything other than a simulacrum. By the way, the fact that androids live for very short might be a wink towards plant obsolescence, which is closely tied to the negative aspects of the profit motive that drives capitalism. Although, I have to admit that libertarians make a good case for why planned obsolescence is, in fact, a net good. Speaking of motivations, Rick Deckard's primary motivation for hunting the Nexus 6 androids seems to be the reward money with which he intends to buy a new animal. However, during his hunt, we are exposed to Rick's internal conflict with killing androids, asking, on behalf of the reader, what justifies their elimination. This question arises in multiple instances. First, when Rick's wife refers to them as poor Andes, later, when he finds himself attracted to a female android, then, when he discovers he can empathize with certain androids, and lastly, when he finds himself appreciating the talent of an android who hides as an acclaimed opera singer. I'm unsure how it jives with the character, but Rick loves the opera. Rick himself is a deeply conflicted and somewhat depressed individual. He seems to conduct an unhappy life in an unhappy marriage and doing a job he doesn't enjoy. While religion and media play a substantial role in most people's lives, Rick doesn't seem to be deeply concerned with either, although, importantly, it will be religion that saves him. But I'll get to that later. During his journey of self-discovery, Rick teams up with another bounty hunter who's suspected to be an android himself, and later he's joined by a female android tasked with helping him capture and kill the last remaining androids. Being a man, he obviously ends up boning her, which is a big effing illegal no-no in that world. Although, he doesn't actually do it out of the standard male instinct. Instead, he's following a piece of advice from another bounty hunter. Apparently, retiring female androids is easier if you first sleep with them. Men truly are mysterious creatures. Incidentally, in an act of revenge, that same female android goes on to kill his brand new expensive animal, which he bought with some of the bounty money. I guess PKD is reminding us that women are women, human or otherwise. In the end, reaching his physical and psychological limits, Rick finishes all 6 escaped androids. His story ends with a genuine spiritual revelation that, unfortunately, crashes against the disappointing fakery of the world he inhabits. Besides Rick, there's a supporting character in the book named John Isidore. John is a special, a term describing genetically degenerated people with low cognitive abilities. Although it seems that most people in that world use the derogatory term chickenhead. To quote how the book's description of him started, he had been a special now for over a year, and not merely in regard to the distorted genes which he carried. Worse still, he had failed to pass the minimum mental faculties test, which made him, in popular parlance, a chickenhead. Upon him, the contempt of three planets descended. However, despite this, he survived. John Isidore lives in a completely empty building in the abandoned suburbs of San Francisco until three of the six escaped androids move into the building. Seeing the androids as belonging to the same class of undesirables, John decides to help them hide from and fight Rick. Interestingly, he remains loyal to them even after they deride his most cherished religious beliefs and moral virtues. And with that, I think you are well armed enough to dive into the novel's societal and socio-political characteristics, which we will do in the next part of this chapter. Like always, I wish to thank you for listening all the way to the end, and if you made it this far, why not consider supporting my work? Links in the description box. And remember, don't do to others what is hurtful to you, and don't let the bad guys win. See you in part 2.